The Trust for Sustainable Living presents Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast about the environment and the issues our planet faces. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Sarah Benn, representing the Doctors for Extinction Rebellion, as part of our mini-series on climate action in response to the UN Climate Change Conference. Today's episode is hosted by Jasmine Barrett.
First things first, would you be able to kind of introduce yourself, tell us a bit about you and what you do?
Okay, so my name's Sarah Benn. I live in Birmingham and I work as a GP. I've worked over 30 years in the NHS, mostly as an inner city GP in Birmingham. I've got three children and I've had a kind of long time concern and interest in sustainability and ecological and climate issues, which has been becoming progressively more and more of a concern over recent years.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're not the only one there who has got progressively more and more concerned. I myself have, but I guess as a doctor, you can kind of see the effects. Yeah, that's one of the things we wanted to ask you about, actually, in terms of people coming into the practice and you seeing your patients. Do you see the effects of climate change in terms of, I don't know, more pollution and worse kind of respiratory conditions?
Yeah, that's the big one, really, because my patients haven't really been impacted by, because of where we live, simply because of sort of rising sea levels or floods, although plenty have sort of experienced some flooding disruption, but not to make a bigger impact on their health. But pollution, air pollution, absolutely, definitely. As I said, I've worked over 20 years in inner city Birmingham. And what I've seen more and more as the years go by is, at a very basic level, people coughing. So kids who just cough, 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 wheeze, not only in the winter when they get a bit of a chest infection or pick up a virus, but just all the time. And they don't get better after a course of antibiotics, or they do very briefly, and then it starts again. Climbing levels of asthma and sort of lung sensitivity, people's allergies, hay fever getting worse. And at the other sort of end of the age spectrum, people with the chronic diseases like COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, heart disease, cerebrovascular disease, all these sort of diseases of aging getting worse and impacting more and more on people's lives, and going, particularly the respiratory one. And I'm very aware of how exposed people in the inner cities are to it. You know, kids are pushed around in pushchairs, you know, at the level of car exhausts, and they inhale it. So yes, I've seen lots and lots of effects of pollution, thunderstorm asthma. So the sort of combination of pollution and climate change is really bad. As we have more sort of chaotic weather, thunderstorms and so on, and increased greenhouse gases in the air from fossil fuel burning, you get more pollen coming into the air, which triggers people's allergies. It's pulled up essentially into thunderclouds, and the pollen then, because of osmotic effects with rainwater, it's broken down into much smaller particles, rained down in a thunderstorm, and you get loads and loads of people having asthma attacks. So see that as well. So yeah, air pollution has got to be the big one. I guess the other places I see it impacting directly on people's health, the heat waves that we've had. At a personal level, my mum is 83 and frail and elderly, and she and the people, you know, who live close to her in her sort of elderly living place, they absolutely struggle with the heat. You know, they're just laid flat by it. And I see it in patients who become dehydrated. You know, their blood salts are all over the shop because they are too hot and dehydrated. And it's not simply a matter of being uncomfortable. They end up in hospital, you know, for days and days to get it all sorted out again. So the heat is particularly a problem. The other thing I notice, and I'm just deliberately focusing on like my experience as a doctor, because that's what you asked about, not globally climate change, but is the kind of psychological toll that it's taking. Young people in particular, I think, as Greta Thunberg has very eloquently said, you know, my future has been stolen from me. And young people are starting to realise what their future may look like. And they're justifiably angry and upset and feel hopeless about things. Those of my generation and older, I think are enduring and will endure increasingly the sort of the moral injury from the realization of being complicit in causing all this, albeit unwittingly, but causing the wreckage and the ruination of our planet for our children and grandchildren. And it's terrifying and deeply, deeply depressing. And that's one of the themes that comes across when you start talking to people about it. I don't want to talk about it because it's so depressing. A big lot of sort of psychological difficulty there that we're kind of seeing after COVID. It's like that, but it's going to be much worse.
I mean, just on a couple of things there, I have asthma myself and have always noticed that after it's rained, it's worse. And I never really kind of realized why, because I thought surely it would be better because it's, you know, not as hot, but never really thought about the fact that the pollen will kind of go up and be broken down into smaller pieces almost, and then, you know, make it easier for people to breathe in. As well, you mentioned about, you know, the psychological effect, and that is something that I have seen, you know, as part of the younger generation, from my friends, from people in universities, students, all of it, you know, are really quite concerned. So it's definitely got its impact. And in terms of actually other ways in which some people should be a bit concerned maybe about climate change, because you were talking about your individual experience, as you mentioned, but more globally and in terms of maybe a bit broader, or what other effects there are, why should the public care about climate change and their health?
Essentially because it's going to get worse and worse and worse. So the big things, food insecurity. I mean, it is actually already happening in the UK. I think the National Farmers Union forecast their worst wheat harvest ever last year, because of the sort of the changed weather, with drought and then downpours and so on. But, you know, we're already seeing that around the world. It's well established, and it's going to happen here. And you've only got to see what happened with COVID and a bit of panic buying and shelves empty. And that's going to be a reality. If we lose the breadbaskets of the world to drought and desert, then that will impact on all of us. Climate refugees. Again, that is going to start happening in the UK very soon. There's a village in Wales called Fishbourne that has been decommissioned because the council have decided that they simply won't be able to afford the defences, the flood defences over the next 25 years to make it safe. And so people have to leave their homes. And that's, you know, within 25 years in the UK. But it's happening already all around the world. And we're seeing climate refugees who understandably, you know, move because there's no food, there's no water where they live. They end up in sort of big camps. It causes tensions over resources and it ends up in armed conflict. And people are already worried in the UK about influx of refugees from other areas of the world. And although they want to, most people want to do the kind and human thing and welcome them because they've gone through terrible things, there's also a real fear about how will we cope with that as it happens more and more and more. And I don't know the answer to that, because it will happen more and more and more. Disease. Microbes like warm, moist conditions. So we are now seeing in Europe the effect of that. So malaria outbreaks in France from locally transmitted cases. Now, that's not very far away from us. They found in parts of southern England, the Asian tiger mosquito, to look at my notes there, which is now able to survive in little spots in southern England. And that carries lovely things like Zika, which is the one that caused all the birth defects overseas, encephalitis, dengue fever, you know, these things, these sort of tropical diseases that we're not used to. And the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Health have said, you know, that some parts of southern England now are warm enough to sustain malaria outbreaks from mosquitoes. So yeah, disease. Things, 75% of new human diseases have jumped across from animals. COVID is one of them. There's debate about exactly where the original COVID infection came from, you know, whether it's from a Chinese lab or from wet markets or whatever, but it originated in animals. And as I say, 75% of new human diseases come from there. And that's going to happen more and more and more. People have been warning for years and years about a pandemic that's animal in origin, because animals are being driven closer and closer to human habitation, having to migrate because their habitats are being destroyed through deforestation, industrial agriculture, and so forth. And they're migrating because of climate change. They no longer have the conditions they need to survive and find food. So they'll move closer and closer to human populations. Because we've got this system of, say, intensive animal agriculture, these wild animals come into close proximity, viruses are spread, and then they jump to humans. And that really frightens me, because we've seen what a single virus has done with COVID. And we've had warnings with SARS and bird flu, you know, just waiting for the next one. So, There's just a few reasons why we should be worried about climate change globally. And just because, you know, as human beings, we're all moved by the terrible sights that we see on the news, you know, and there's no doubt about that, because whenever there's a famine or a terrible flood or some sort of ghastly armed conflict, and we see the women and the children and the elderly and the sick suffering, you know, we open our pockets and our hearts to them during that little episode. So we kind of do care. But so much of that is driven by competition over resources because of drought, crop failures, people increasingly being pushed together into places that can't sustain them. And that's when societies start to fragment, break down, wars start, and so on, like Syria. So yeah, it's so that's why we should care about it, because at the very least we're going to be seeing more and more and more of that awful stuff, and it's going to get closer and closer to us in the UK on our doorstep. But even if it isn't, it's just not, you know, I think everybody at a visceral level, when they see starving children on the TV, even if it's just for a few minutes, they think, that's not right. I don't want to live in a world like that. I want to do something. So they give some money, because that's what they can do at that point. And climate change is driving all of that more and more and more and more. Sorry, I babbled on for a bit there. Just say stop if you want me to move on. Or
No, that's all right, actually. A lot of what you said there is something that I've been thinking about myself recently as well. I'm actually reading this book, The Uninhabitable Earth by David Wallace Wells. And it says pretty much exactly that like, this isn't something that's far off. It's not something that's in the future, you know. Those diseases and those outbreaks that we've had, they're here. You mentioned France, we've just had COVID. I remember swine flu from back in my childhood. And the UK, like you said, can sustain some of those bug populations that we haven't seen before. So it's not something to worry about, it's something to worry about now, which I think is very apt and something that we should definitely be acting on. Speaking of that action, we obviously got in contact with you through Doctors for Extinction Rebellion, and we saw a YouTube provided by the person that we got in contact with, a YouTube video, and in that you spoke about signing petitions, writing letters, but things still obviously kept getting worse and worse. Is this what inspired you to get involved with Doctors for XR? Were there any kind of like deciding factors?
Yeah, I spent a very long time being very worried about the unsustainability of our way of life and climate change, both, but without any sort of feeling that anything I was doing could really make a difference. So I've done everything that I can over many years to shrink my own carbon footprint. So I don't fly, I'm vegan, we have solar panels, I use public transport as much as I can, and minimal use of our single electric car. I've stopped buying stuff, you know, I rarely buy anything if I can help it. And I've been, you know, a diligent member of the Green Party, supported environmental causes, signed petitions, whatever. But really had lost hope that anything was ever going to change. And then came across Extinction Rebellion, not Doctors for Extinction Rebellion, but Extinction Rebellion, the movement, in early 2019. A few months after it had launched, and watched with my husband the film, a filmed talk called Heading for Extinction and What to Do About It. And the Heading for Extinction bit is deeply depressing, terrifying, whatever. And the what to do about it was all about how non-violent direct action, civil disobedience can be effective in making big changes. And the history of that, which I did know about, you know, Gandhi, the suffragettes, the American Civil Rights Movement, but how those movements have been successful employing those tactics. And we sat and watched it and thought, oh my goodness, that is something really different. And wow, what a great idea. We can't do that. You know, we're kind of good law-abiding citizens. That's kind of for somebody else to do. And it took a little bit to kind of get my head around that, because I have been a lifelong conformist. You know, I was a goody two shoes at school, and I've never really been involved in activism at all, other than, as I say, at a very low level, you know, signing petitions and that kind of thing. But just sort of thought, well, how can I not take part in this? And that's how I went along to the April 2019 Extinction Rebellion in London to kind of check it out with my family. And it all kind of went on from there. And I came across Doctors for Extinction Rebellion a few months after that, just before the video clip that you saw, because they were planning this action at the Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy Building. And I sort of just made contact with Chris Newman, the guy that put you onto me. And said, yeah, I'm up for that. And literally a few days later, found myself super gluing my hand to a glass door and, you know, talking to camera about Doctors for Extinction Rebellion. And it's kind of carried on from there. I think doctors and health professionals generally are uniquely placed to have a voice in this, because number one, because of the health impacts, because it affects, you know, it's the biggest one of all, life, you know, the existence of life, let alone health. And the science of it. And we are still trusted voices in society, ahead of politicians, journalists, many other occupational groups, for better or worse, that's how it is. So we have a voice which is not available to other members. And if I can't say something, then who can? So I think that gives a weight to it. Also because I think doctors are seen to be generally, yeah, conformist, abiding by professional codes of conduct and so on, and kind of held almost to a higher standard, as they should be, about how they conduct themselves. So it makes people stop and take note and ask, why? Why is this woman doing this? I mean, certainly that's been the response of some of my family and friends. What on earth has got into her? And that opens up conversations as to why and how urgent it is. So I guess that's what drew me to XR generally, and Doctors for XR is part of that.
Definitely. And I mean, you mentioned there about the previous movements doing similar things, like the civil rights movement in America and the suffragettes. You know, a lot of people ask, well, one of the questions and the things that I hear or see most often is like, you know, what is it going to achieve? Well, look at what it's achieved in the past. You know, it is something that works or has worked, so why not try it for this too? And I think you've spoken about this a little bit kind of throughout most of your answers, but maybe if there is a brief way to put it, why are doctors involved in Extinction Rebellion? Because you've talked about their unique position and the effects that they can see, but is there anything else about kind of the reasons why doctors are so concerned about this?
I think, you know, there's a moral duty to on us to act. We are incredibly privileged members of society. We have essentially secure jobs and incomes and so on. We've been educated. We've got a lot of privilege, a lot of clout. And yeah, if we don't say something, who can? And we have a duty to do stuff to protect other people from coming to harm. And if we see risk to life and health, then how can we justify not acting in the best way that we can, or in a way that seems to offer the best hope of making some change? And as you said, a lot of people say, well, you know, how is this gonna do any good? I don't know that it will succeed, but you know, if there's even a 1% chance, how can you not try, knowing the alternative? So I think medicine is quite an ethics-driven sort of profession. We spend a lot of time debating, you know, what's the right thing to do in very complex areas. So we're used to sort of weighing these things up and so on, and making a call which is not straightforward, and having to argue the case both ways. And I would love there to be a different way that I thought would work to make changes. I would love to not disrupt people, not sit in a road, not get arrested and sit in a police cell. You know, it's not fun. Don't do it for kicks. And as soon as a better way comes along, I'll be there.
Absolutely. You mentioned, you know, you're a self-confessed conformist, always have been. And we saw you doing some of the action that you've talked about in the video that we've mentioned, and that we will link and share with our viewers as well. But as somebody who has said, you know, you don't like upsetting people, and you were nervous initially. So in terms of getting involved in XR, and what kind of made you get outside of your comfort zone? How did you gain that confidence?
I think it just happened through, I guess, watching this video with my husband. That was the kind of turning point for me. But it took a couple of months of just sort of talking about that, and then going along to London. We didn't join a local group or anything at that point. We didn't even know that there was one. So we turned up at London, and suddenly realized there were all these other people that felt exactly like we did and had been feeling that way for years and years. That exact same fear, anxiety, depression and helplessness, and had all come together and were all on the same page. You know, something must be done, and doing it together is, you know, so much easier than by yourself. So that was a big part, kind of being part of a community who are immensely supportive and creative and loving and just, you know, sincere, decent people. And hearing their stories, I think that has to be the main reason.
For sure. Everything is much easier when you have people to support you, right? I mean, we talk about that as a human race, full stop. So for people who are nervous, who don't necessarily feel like they want to get involved, but still feel like they want to do something, finding a group or reaching out is probably the way to go about it, or to boost their confidence. But as a group then, as, you know, the Doctors for Extinction Rebellion, we were wondering kind of what motivates you to take the direct action. You know, you plan the protests, and they, as you have mentioned, can be disruptive. You know, what are the aims of that disruption almost?
So we know that non-disruptive protest, handing out leaflets in shopping centres, going on marches, however big, don't change anything because that's been done. Disruptive action, it gets people's attention. It doesn't get people's approval by and large, but it gets people's attention. And it pushes the people who have some power, governments and so forth, into a position where they have to take a stance, either to allow that disruption and protest to continue or to clamp down on it and have people arrested and punished, both of which bring more attention, more debate. And I honestly think that if everybody in the UK knew the scale and severity of the climate and ecological emergency, that there would be, this would be front page news every single day, like COVID. It would be discussed ad nauseam in people's homes, workplaces, everywhere. And things would happen. It would have to happen. And that is Extinction Rebellion's first demand: tell the truth. And we still haven't got there. You know, the vast majority of people are now aware that there's a problem with climate, but they don't realise how urgent it is. And if it was, if we had 20, 30 years, then I wouldn't be causing disruption. But we don't. We don't know quite how long we've got, but it's probably just a few years. So why cause disruption? Yeah, it essentially gets people's attention. It gets them talking about it. And that's when things start to happen. And Extinction Rebellion is not about telling the UK or the world or everybody what to do, how to solve this. It's about highlighting it and then giving the choices to people, you know, everybody. Everybody should have a voice in this, but they can't unless they know what the problem is. And that's why, you know, XR advocates citizens' assemblies to make difficult decisions and choices and recommendations for the government to then enact on behalf of everybody. It's not for me to tell other people how to live their lives. If somebody says, you know, how can I reduce my carbon footprint or what can I do or whatever? Yeah, at a one-to-one level, I can kind of say, oh, you might want to do this or that or whatever. But I don't preach to people. I don't tell people how to live their lives. Everybody collectively has to get together and, confronted with the scale of the problem, decide together what they are prepared to do to get out of this and to make some kind of decent future for themselves, their children, their grandchildren. It's not for individuals or even a government to say, this is how you've got to live your life. I mean, I'm a hypocrite just sitting here, because every breath that I draw, every meal that I eat, everything that I do, that's my carbon footprint. And the best way I could shrink that to its minimum is to jump off a cliff. You know, that's the essence of it. So who am I to tell anyone how to live their life? But I really believe that if everybody knew the dire situation that we're in and that we're hurtling towards that cliff that we're going to drop off, that they would collectively say, yeah, God, we need to do something. We, like, now. And it's bringing that stuff to people's attention. And I've had some really good conversations with members of the public who've been quite angry. You know, if they're furious angry, then it's difficult to make any headway, but have just not understood, you know, why are they being disrupted by this. Conversations with police officers, with security people, who just haven't really couldn't understand why I was deliberately doing something to disrupt their day-to-day life. And then at the end of it, have sort of said, right, okay, yeah, I get that. They might still not agree with it, but if it prompts people to go away and spend a few hours just digging at it, you know, I say to people, don't believe what I say, you know, don't, I'm not going to direct you to a website or whatever, because it's all out there. If you just go and research it a bit, you'll find out stuff, and that will lead you to more stuff and more stuff and more stuff. And at the end of it, then you decide what you personally want to do about it. And people will, but they need to know first. And that's where the disruption comes in, because I think it has a proven track record in bringing stuff to people's attention. The other thing is that there's this sort of disruption. For the people doing the disruption, it does entail a level of sacrifice. If it's done to the point of arrest and penalties, legal penalties, that again, people will think, well, why is this otherwise respectable person, you know, who's not made a career out of causing trouble, you know, they're being punished for trying to make the world a better place. How is that right? I want to know more. And that's where things may change, when people want to know more and start looking at it themselves.
Yeah, so those conversations that you have with people off at the back of the kind of effects of the disruption, you've talked about, you know, having those conversations with people who are angry and are frustrated. Would you be able to share a little bit more maybe about how you do deal with that backlash that you get? What is it that you say to those security guards and those policemen and whoever else to kind of make them aware of the issue?
What I found, first of all, I take a very deep breath because I find it very exhausting. But I tell them my sort of personal where I am, and I say, sorry, I am really genuinely, I don't want to be doing this. It's a lovely day. I'd rather be in the park with my kids. But I'm doing this for my kids and for your kids, because, and I know it's spoiling your day, but what I am genuinely terrified of is the very much more spoiling of everybody's day that is coming down the tracks in a few years' time if something is not done. And this is what science is telling us is going to happen. And I think people will make, it's often said to me, oh, people will never give up their big cars, they'll never give up their flying to, you know, hot places, and they'll never change their dietary habits, they'll never give up their luxuries. And I think that's really not true. People will do extraordinary things for those that they love, children in particular, because there's this kind of, you know, this, it's hardwired into our system to protect our children. But, you know, we have these very strong bonds as humans with our parents, siblings, friends, colleagues, and people will do incredible things to protect those other people from immediate harm and suffering and pain and so on. You know, anyone, I keep going back to parents, and that's not to belittle other things, but parents will crawl over broken glass for their kids. And if we are able to sort of do that, then it's easy to give up a few things, to know that is, it's not just about making a better future for our children, it's about protecting them from real awful harm. You know, not just, well, there isn't any fresh bread on the shelf at Tesco's, but there's nothing at all. You know, there's no food on the shelf. It's not just about, oh, I've got to wait 6 months for my operation because of NHS waiting lists. It's about, there is no hospital open and functioning that I can go to with my broken limb. It's not about there being a bit of, you know, crime, you know, burglaries and muggings and so on. It's about real daily violence on the streets because of societal breakdown. All these things that we take for granted that can be so quickly snatched away. And you've only got to look at other places in the world where it's happening. And you can always say to somebody that you talk to in the street, you know, you see what's going on in whatever place of the world is at that particular time. All those photographs, pictures, video stuff of desperate people passing their babies over a wire saying, please take my child. It's that we're trying to avoid. And at the moment, we're on this truck heading for a cliff. And when it goes over the cliff and hits the floor, that's what will happen, all those terrible things. And the problem is that once we go over the cliff edge, we'll have a little while before we hit the ground. We'll have a few years to contemplate that that is going to happen for sure and how terrible it's going to be. But we won't be able to claw our way back up to the edge of the cliff. And this is my way, this that I'm doing today, that I am blocking this road or disrupting your day. This is my way of shouting at the top of my voice, for God's sake, somebody put the brakes on, turn the steering wheel. We have to stop ourselves going off that cliff edge. And this is my way of shouting. And you may not like the disruption of having your journey altered, but it's to avoid that terrible thing that is coming. And if I just say, oh, by the way, I'd really like it if we slowed down a bit, or if we turned off the road a bit left here before this cliff edge, nobody listens. But if you're the person who says, stop, emergency, then people might not like that message, but it's likely to do more than the sort of polite request. So every conversation is different, and it's odd doing it, like, you know, in this situation when it's for real. It's like a bit of a back and forth and so on, because usually people are at a different sort of point at where you are. And but it's those kind of things.
You come up with some fabulous quotes and sentences, I must say. I keep noting them down, little quotes to like use. But one of the things we wanted to ask you about, you know, you're talking about we're heading for such a disaster, you know, there's so many horrible things that can happen. And recently we've seen a lot of protests, not just by Extinction Rebellion, but also by Insulate Britain, blocking roads, causing people to be late, costing them money and time. But yet when you put those things side by side with things like torrential rain and floods that are blocking the same roads and causing the same waste of money and the same cost of time, do you think that illustrates, you know, your protests illustrate, when they see these things side by side, the problem? Mm. Do people pay attention?
Well, they're starting to. That's the thing. And it's very uncomfortable when you're the one delivering the message, because so many times people say, oh, I totally agree with your cause, but not the way you're doing it. But yeah, I mean, Insulate Britain, that's a case in point. And I was just reading in the online newspaper this morning, there was somebody, a driver, who was quoted as saying, I've got to pick my grandchild up because my daughter's gone into labour. And yeah, you can feel that sort of, oh my God, I've got to be there. Why is this happening? That anger and real distress that I can't be where I need to be because this is happening. But yeah, the distress that is coming down the line a few years distant is just going to dwarf that. And it's sort of putting that together. Unfortunately, it's not easy to do that in a soundbite on a banner. It takes some explaining. And I guess with the Insulate Britain thing, I'll be having some discussions with family and friends about, you know, how, why that's being done and that sort of backstory to it. But that's the bottom line. And I really feel for that lady who can't get to be where she's going to be, where she wants to be and needs to be. But that's the reason why people are doing it. And they don't want to do it. They feel driven to it because nothing else is working. The Parliament declared a climate emergency on 1st of May 2019, just after the Extinction Rebellion, April Rebellion, in a direct result. Unfortunately, they haven't done anything about it with any of the urgency that is required. But it happened. I don't think anybody would refute that it happened as a result. So something is heard. And I guess we've just got to keep on shouting like that in a direct, disruptive, but non-violent way. And it will always be non-violent.
I think actually that's a very good point to make. You know, the aim is disruption, not violence. And I think people sometimes get the two a bit confused. But hopefully as a result of the disruption, things like violence and all the other disastrous effects are going to be avoided. So really, you know, it is for the best, which you can tell people when they come up to you and they want that conversation, or even if they ask you a question. But for the people that don't, for the people that just straight up refuse, are too angry, or are even like climate deniers, you know, what do we say to them?
I think climate denial is reducing, definitely, and will continue to do so. There will always be a small element of it, but it's definitely becoming a less tenable position. But yeah, those people who are angry and so on, in the moment, it's probably anything that is said is not going to change their mind. But there will be a few who are provoked into going and finding out a bit more, if only to prove that they are right and we are wrong, and that may lead on to other things. It doesn't happen overnight or in one conversation. And that's why, you know, marches, you know, a million people marched against the Iraq war. And what happened? We went to war. A march or something on one day, it doesn't cut it, because everybody feels great for having taken part. And, you know, some people who see it think, oh, that's great, isn't it? And then everybody goes home and nothing happens. So it's sustaining it so that it's always a topic on people's minds. And opinion does change. And actually, you know, all those movements that we spoke of before, it has not depended on a majority of the population agreeing with the disruptive tactics. It's about getting people to open up to the cause, what's behind it, the arguments as to why it's taking place. it's not about being popular. It's about starting those discussions and people's thinking processes. And it doesn't happen overnight. It does take time.
And I mean, we've talked about discussions with so many different kind of people. And in different contexts, you know, we've talked about what it's like with your patients and what you would say to climate deniers and what you say to the people that you come across. But one of the things that we lastly wanted to ask you today is something that we're kind of trying to ask all of our guests this season is, if you got the chance to kind of sit down with those world leaders, what would you say?
I'd say, do you believe this stuff? If not, you know, and by stuff, I mean what the scientists are united in telling us and their predictions about a 2-degree world, a 3-degree world, and when that's likely to happen. Do you believe that? If not, why not? And but if you do, why are you not with me doing whatever it takes to avoid that? Do you have people in this world that you care about? You know, because if you do, and for you yourself, if you have more than a 10-year life expectancy, are you not terrified of what's going to happen? If not, you know, why not? And if you are, why are you doing stuff that is, or why are you not doing stuff to avoid it, or doing stuff that is so obviously unfit for purpose and just pretending that it's going to solve the problem? And at a personal level, what are you going to say to your kids, grandkids, people that you care about, when they turn around in a few years' time and say, you knew about this, you knew about it, why didn't you say something? Why didn't you warn people? And you also had the power to do something. So why didn't you do something? And, or what you did, why was it so little, so late? What's your excuse? And how are you going to feel having that conversation with those people? What's it going to do to you? Or wouldn't you rather be able to look them in the eye and say, I did the best I could, and you know that I did the best I could because you saw me doing it over these years. You saw me trying my best to sound the alarm, to do something, even though it was really difficult and people criticized me and it entailed difficulty and censure. You know I tried my best to do something about it. So which of those two conversations do you want to have with your children? Because I know which one I would rather have and which one I am not going to have.
Absolutely. I'm exactly the same. I know which one I would want to have. I think everybody, at least at this company, would kind of be the same. What conversation do they want to have? So I think so that is a perfect thing to say to the world leaders, to be honest with you. That's all we had. Thank you so much. We have thoroughly enjoyed everything you said. We've got a little round of applause back there.
well, thank you for, I'm sorry if I get very nervous about these things and I do sort of babble on a bit. And usually it's only a couple of minutes that I have to babble on. So, it's been great to talk. And I'd, at a personal level, you are a young person and I feel so much saying these things to you know I'm saying these things about our children and our young people and so on, and it's you. And I it must feel a very heavy load doing what you're doing. Yeah, the knowledge that you have.
Yeah, I guess to a certain extent it feels like you don't have a choice. You know I've got to be involved, I've got to do something about it, or what else is there? But luckily for me, it's something that I enjoy, so not too much of a burden, I guess. But yeah, thank you so much. We have thoroughly enjoyed this, and we are really, really grateful that you spoke with us today. Turns out you are a perfect guess.
Okay, well, that's lovely to hear, and yeah, I shall look forward to hearing myself. and thank you for doing what you're doing.
This has been Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast by the Trust for Sustainable Living. Thank you to today's guest, Dr. Sarah Benn. Hosted by Jasmine Barron. Organised by Jasmine Barron and Sonny Tierney. Music by Billy Painter. Find us online by going to trustforsustainableliving.org.